First of all, today is the last Tuesday morning of this year. We're going to break after this. But there is more learning to come, so come along to the summer learning program, which starts on the 25th of December until the 1st of January. Right. So what I want to do today is share with you, first of all, something short on the parasha, because I thought, still parasha share, after all. And then we'll do some Hanukkah concepts, one or potentially two, to see how we go with time. Okay, so the first one is just to share with you a thought on that I saw about the dreams of Paro and his response to Yosef. So we know that Paro has a dream. It's the Parshas of dreams. He has two dreams, one with seven lean cows, seven fat cows, then seven good ears of corn and seven bad ears of corn. Both of them are very similar. Both cows are there at the same time. The thin cows eat up the fat cows. The good corn eats up the bad corn. And he's all very disturbed. Rashi says, Parsha says that he calls together his magicians. He asks them, and no interpretation that they gave him settled his mind. They say, you'll have seven daughters, and I'll die, and this, that, and the other, all kinds of different things. And he was very, very upset until the Saramashkim, the butler, suddenly remembered that he'd forgotten Yosef. After 2 years, said to Paro, there was this Hebrew lad in prison with me. He interpreted dreams very well. So why don't you get him? So he comes, and he tells Yosef the dreams again. And this is what happens then. I've copied it. You don't need Chumash, because I've copied it on the thing. So let's just read through. What's that? Let's just read some of the
parashas.
Sorry, Miketz, sorry. Sorry. That's a good point. The reason it's called Miketz, by the way, because it says Vayhi Miketz. It actually starts off the middle of a story. It was the end of Miketz means the end of 2 years. 2 years was the 2 years that the butler had forgotten Yosef. Yosef had asked the butler to remember him, to Paro, and he'd forgotten him. Okay. So Vayomer Yosef el Paro. So Yosef says to Paro, Chalom Paro Echadu. You should know the dream of Paro is one dream. Because Esa Asher Osrael was, you dreamt two dreams, but it's actually one dream. Because Esa Asher Elakim Oisa, it's what God is going to do. Oh gosh, look, that was copied. Higid La Pare. Okay, this is copied and pasted very badly, so we don't have to. No, that's a computer glitch, obviously. I don't know why it does it. It's really strange. Alright, so I'm not going to tell you. I'll do it outside. What happens is as follows. So Yosef says to Paro, it's all one dream. What happens is that the seven cows represent 7 years, and so do the 7 years of corn. And what's going to happen is as follows. There's going to be seven very, very good years. Years of plentiful. Years of really fullness of produce and so on and so forth. Which is going to be followed by seven very, very lean years. Years of famine. He says the reason that Paro had the two dreams, he says really one dream, which is because Hashem is about to do it very swiftly, and for emphasis, Hashem gave it to him in two different messages, and there were two dreams. Then Yosef continues and he says, this is what you need to do, Yosef says to Paro. You need to appoint someone that's going to, during the full years, to gather produce, and to make sure that there's plenty stored away, so that you have what to eat during the years of famine, which is exactly what happened. And Paro is unbelievably impressed. Unbelievably impressive. That's an amazing interpretation, and you must be the right guy to do it, and therefore we appoint you the viceroy of Egypt. And Yosef became the guy, and that's exactly what happened. They collected this amazing amount of produce during the years of thing, and then during years of famine there was plenty to eat, to the point that even where the famine had spread to the land of Israel, for example, where they didn't have what to eat, they heard that in Mitzrayim there's plenty to eat. And therefore, that's the whole story of how the brothers eventually came down to Egypt, because they came down to Egypt to buy supplies because of the famine.
Is it true that Paro had the dream interpreted to him when he was asleep, and when he woke up, he couldn't get a satisfactory answer?
Possibly. I know that's true. I'm not sure about this. I know that's true with regard to the butler and the baker. Butler and the baker says that the baker saw that Paro had interpreted the butler's dream very well. He asked for his interpretation too. What does that mean? Because what happened was, there they each dreamt their dream and the interpretation of the others.
Oh, right.
So when the butler when the butler had his dream interpreted, the baker knew that's a good interpretation because he had dreamt the interpretation. He had dreamt what's going to happen to the butler in the next few days. But it's possible with Pari also that was like that, but yeah, not in the line of thought that we're following. So I don't know. Maybe there's a view that way. I'm not sure. But there's two questions on this, which are really the two questions answer each other. The two questions as follows. First of all, what actually impressed Pari with this interpretation? In other words, what was so different about what Yosef had said to what the others had said? I mean, there were some very credible interpretations about all to do with the number seven. There'll be seven good and seven bad.
He did it simultaneously. He could reconcile both.
Oh. Okay.
Doesn't he say if you store in the, then it will go for the bad?
Okay, so that's the point I want to bring across.
Yeah.
Because it goes with another question. The question is, and that's why we know that. And that becomes part of the interpretation. Because if you look at it on the surface, well, it's a very strange thing. Yosef was like a little kid. He was a young guy just coming out of jail. I mean, he'd been a guy languishing in jail till 5 minutes ago. He's pulled out to give interpretations. He's able to give interpretations. And suddenly, like a real Jewish guy, he's giving etzos already. Like he's standing in prayer for 5 minutes and he's already advising him what to do. He wasn't asked for advice. He was asked for interpretation of a dream. And Pari accepts that. But that's the answer. The answer is that the advice is actually part of the interpretation. Because what bothered Pari about the dreams was that no interpretation could explain why the good cows and the bad cows were standing next to each other at the same time. Because all interpretations with what something good, the number seven, happening, followed by something bad. Which never answered the one detail of his dream of how they were standing there together. And that's why Yosef continued with the interpretation. The interpretation wasn't an advice. It wasn't unsolicited advice. The interpretation was actually part of the interpretation. And he says, because you want to know why they were standing there together, it's because this is what you need to do. The dream is telling you what you need to do. The dream is telling you that you need to collect the produce during the seven good years so that you have them in the seven bad years so that the plentiful and the famine will happen together. So it'll be years of famine and the good cows will still be there. And when Pari heard that, he thought, that's what fits. And that's... Sorry?
The good years
of famine and the good years will be together because the plentiful food left over from the good years will still remain. And that's why Pari was so impressed, because of the advice. And that answers the question of why he was so excited about the advice, because the advice actually was part of the dream. It was part of the interpretation. Okay, that's just a little vart on the parsha, because it is a parsha shir. So then I'm going to go to Hanukkah. And... Alright, so I want to learn through with you something interesting about Hanukkah that comes from the Gemara. If you have a look at the last second part of the page, let's learn through something to do with Hanukkah, and then we'll try and analyze it a little bit. So it says like this: Tafresh Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught us Mitzvah Sner Hanukkah. The mitzvah of Hanukkah, ner ish ubeisoi. The minimum weight, the minimum requirement to fulfill the mitzvah of Hanukkah is to have actually one candle per family each night. Most people don't know this, but actually, even if you light one candle each night, that for one per household, that fulfills the mitzvah. The hamahadrim, but if you do the mitzvah a little bit more carefully, in a nice way, ner lechol echad ve'echad, then it's a candle for each and every member of the family. So, for example, you've got five members of the family, so then it's five candles per night, right? Not like we do it now, but five. Now, mahadrin, mina mahadrin, if you do it extra well, the Rolls Royce version of the mitzvah, then it's a different system altogether, and here we have a dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai oimrim yoim rishon madlik shmoina. Beis Shammai say that on the first day you have to light eight candles. Mikan ve'eilech, from then onwards, poiches ve'hoilech, you go down. Beis Hillel says, Yom Rishon Madlik Achas, the first day you light one. Mikan ve'eilech, moisi ve'hoilech, from then on you keep adding one to eight. Okay. There's a famous dispute between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. Interesting what that actually means. Is that to replace... In other words, there's three levels of Hanukkah. There's minimum requirement, upgrade one, and upgrade two. Right? So the question is, does upgrade 2 replace upgrade 1 or adds to upgrade 1? In other words, like this. If you've got 5 people in the house, so upgrade 1 says you light 5 candles each night. If you've got to upgrade 2, does that mean now it's 5, 10, 15? Or does it mean you cancel upgrade 1 and just go to the one person lighting the menorah, 1 to 8? Okay. So we have an interesting dispute here between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. Sfaradim of the view, it's actually interesting how this dispute evolves, because I'll just give you a bit of background. It's interesting. It's one of the famous little riddles. Not riddles, like same riddle. Interesting general knowledge when it comes to Hanukkah. This halachic dispute actually originated between Tosfos, which is a commentary on the Gemara, and the Rambam. Now Tosfos is not one person. Tosfos is a group of people, sages who were the grandchildren of Rashi mainly, and it's a classic commentary on the Chumash, on the Gemara. And they were all Ashkenazim. They lived in Germany and France at the time. That was very Ashkenazic, and they were all Ashkenazim. One of them, by the way, lives in England. You know that? There was one actually from the Baal HaTos that was in England. Interesting piece of general knowledge. But there's no English writings from him, because the Ashkenazim didn't write in foreign language. Had it been the Sephardim, we would actually have stuff in English from that period. But the Sephardim wrote in foreign languages, Ashkenazim didn't. Like the Rambam wrote in Arabic, and others wrote in Arabic, but Ashkenazim didn't. Ashkenazim kept to Lashon Kodesh. Anyway, so they were Ashkenazim, and the Rambam lived around the same time, just a bit after. He was also, in other words, they were all from the period of the Rishonim, right? The Rashi's times and Tosfos and so on. And the Rambam says one view. So Tosfos says that upgrade 2 replaces upgrade 1. In other words, that if you want to do Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, then only one person in the family should write light 1 to 8. Not every person, but one person. The Rambam says, no, upgrade 2 is an addition to upgrade 1. In other words, upgrade 1 is each member of the family, upgrade 2 is everyone in the family. So if his example is, you have 10 people in the family, then the first night is 10, the second night is 20, the third night is 30, and so on and so forth, right? That's the way it happens there on the dispute on that level. When it came to Shulchan Aruch, which is what we follow, essentially, so the original Shulchan Aruch was written by two people, meaning it was written by Rabbi Yosef Kara, who was the Sephardic leader of the Israeli community, and notations were added by the Ramo, which was Rav Moshe Ishelis, which was the Ashkenazic leader of Polish Jewry at the time, yeah? Because at that time, the Sephardim were concentrated in Israel, and the Ashkenazim in Europe, and the Ramo, Rav Moshe Ishelis, was the... In fact, Rav Moshe Ishelis had intended to write a Shulchan Aruch similar to Rabbi Yosef Kara. And then when he heard Rabbi Yosef Kara was doing it, he didn't do it. And all he did was he wrote notes where he argued. So, you know, when you learn the original Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Kara's Shulchan Aruch, if there's a sentence there that he rules something and there's no argument, then you know that the Ramo checked it and he also holds like that. So, in other words, because he's not arguing. But when he argues, he argues. So, Ashkenazim generally follow the Ramo. And Rabbi Yosef Kara, and the Sephardim generally, in not all cases, but generally follow Rabbi Yosef Kara. So what's interesting in this particular thing is that normally Rabbi Yosef Kara is very much disposed to following the Rambam and the Rif, who was Sephardim, and the Ramo followed more the Ashkenazic early authorities. Here, for some reason, it switches. Famous thing, that the Rabbi Yosef Kara suddenly rules like Tosfos, and he says, no, Mahadrim and Mahadrim is only one per family, and the Ramo goes like the Rambam, and he says, no, more than one person can light, even if you want to do it Mahadrim and Mahadrim. And so it remains today, that in Sephardi families, properly Sephardi families, only one person lights, and the whole family is covered by that one menorah. To the point, I'll show you the interesting halachic thing, to the point that Rabbi Vadi Yosef, who was one of the great Sephardic leaders who passed away a few years ago, he rules that if someone is based at home, right, a yeshiva bacher, let's say, who goes to Israel to learn, but really is not... He still has a home in America or Australia, and he's just temporarily there in the dormitory, but his home in Australia or New York. He says that even though they're different time zone, he says that bocher, that yeshiva student or that girl in seminary cannot light their own menorah. They are covered by their family because it goes by the house that you belong to. And therefore, because his father is lighting the menorah back at home, they're covered and they cannot light their own menorah. Whereas Ashkenazim, don't do the Ashkenazim, more than one people light, the minag, the custom of Ashkenazim, most Ashkenazi communities, that it wasn't women. Women are covered by the men, but all the men light. And if the Yeshiva Bacher goes away, he certainly lights his own. And that's where it happens. So it was originally a dispute of how you interpret the Gemara between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but when it came to Halacha, it switched. The Ashkenazi held like the Sephardi, and the Sephardi held like the Ashkenazi. Anyway, that wasn't what I wanted to go into. I was just sharing it with you as an interesting thing.
So is it really incumbent on the men of the house to light?
But no, if there's no men, then women have to... Everyone's obligated to the mitzvah of Hanukkah. That's one of the things of Hanukkah. That although it's a time-bound mitzvah, women are obligated just as men. But the one to actually do it is the man. If there's no man, then the woman does it. Well, if the man doesn't do it, the woman does it. Yeah, it's not a problem. But just when there's a family and the man does it, so that's how it works normally. The man do it. Or in Ashkenazi houses, all the men do it. That's how it works. Why in Ashkenazi families women didn't end up doing their own? That's a whole discussion. No one actually knows exactly why. There's various different suggestions of why that happened, but that's the way the men have developed. One suggestion is that in olden times the menorah was lit at the door, and sometimes not even at the door of the house, but it was lit at the door of the courtyard. So it means people would gather in crowds at the courtyard. All the houses that opened up into the courtyard would gather in the front. In those times, particularly, women wouldn't gather like that in public, together with men, especially. So, therefore, the women remained in the houses, and they didn't. That's one interpretation. And there were various different options. Okay. So bottom line is we go like Beis Hillel. So the Mahadrim and the Mahadrim, we don't do 8 to 1; we do 1 to 8, whether it's everyone or only one person, but it's 1 to 8, right? By the way, that's one of the hints in the name Hanukkah, as we know. That the word Hanukkah stands for Ches Neiros, 8 candles, V'halacha K'Beis Hillel, and the halacha is like Beis Hillel, right? Ches Nun Vav Chafei. That's one of the hints in Hanukkah. Okay. Now, why did Beis Hillel? So Beis Hillel says 1 to 8. Beis Shammai say 8 to 1. Why did they say that? So let's have a look at the Gemara. Amar Ula. So Ula tells us, Pligi Bar Trei Amaroi. There was 2 great sages that had a dispute, B'Ma'arava, in the west, in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yossi Bar Avin was one of them, called Rabbi Yossi Bar Avin, Rabbi Yossi Bar Zvido. Interesting, the same note, same name. So there were 2 great sages, Rabbi Yossi the son of Avin, Rabbi Yossi the son of Zvido, and they had a dispute. They were much later than Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. They had a dispute to explain what the reasons of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are, 1 to 8 or 8 to 1. Now we don't know which one said what, but we know the 2 reasons. Chad Omar, one explained the dispute in the following way. The time of the Beis Shammai, that the reason of Beis Shammai is keneged yomim hanichnosim. The reason of Beis Shammai is the light candles corresponding to the days that are coming, not that have come already, but that are about to come. So on the first night of Hanukkah, how many nights do we still have left to Hanukkah? 8. On the second night, we still have 7. On the third night, we have 6 nights left. That's why you light 8, 7, 6 in descending order. The time of the Beis Hillel, but the reason of Beis Hillel, keneged yomim hayotzim, would be according to the days that we already have. So the first night of Hanukkah, you have the first night. The second night of Hanukkah, you have the second night. And that's why you do it. That's one way of explaining it. In other words, one way of explaining the dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is that it's specifically to do with Hanukkah. It's got to do with the potential days of Hanukkah or the actual days of Hanukkah. That's how it works. Okay? What's interesting, by the way, is, and it's not in the scope of the shiur to go into this in great detail, but it's actually a little bit of a consistent theme between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. We find in the whole of the Gemara, in the whole of Shas, that there are many, many disputes of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel that can all be bunched together and explained in the same way, and that is that Beis Shammai always looks at the potential of something, whereas Beis Hillel looks at the actual of something. Okay, there are many, many disputes like that. So here too, Beis Shammai say that... Beis Shammai say that you look at the potential of Hanukkah, in other words, potentially you have 8 days. And Beis Hillel say you look at it for
the present.
The present, right. I'll give you one example where you see this, a different, completely different halacha, nothing to do with Hanukkah. It's to do with the laws of purity and impurity. So the laws are like this, that in the laws of purity and impurity are very, very complex. And they're very different if you talk about solids or you talk about liquids. Okay? So liquids have a whole different, much stricter laws of susceptibility to impurity than solids do. That's just how it works. There's one food that is a very confusing food because it can be treated as a solid or it can be treated like a liquid. Anyone can guess what it is? No?
Water.
Sorry?
No. Water?
No, water is water. Water is liquid, yeah. Honey.
Honey.
Honey. So the Gemara says like this. Yeah. It depends, yeah. That's what Nora says. Honey is interesting, like it's very thick, and particularly also depends where it is. So when honey is on the honeycomb, it's clearly treated as a solid. Mm-hmm. Okay. When a person takes off the honey of the honeycomb and jars it, puts it in a jar and becomes honey, then you treat it like a liquid. So there's a dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, at which point does it stop being a solid and become like a liquid. So Beis Shammai says, as soon as you decide to take off the honey from the honeycomb and put it and make honey out of it, becomes a liquid. At that point, becomes a liquid. Beis Hillel says, no, mishirasek, when you actually take it off the honeycomb. Same idea. Beis Shammai would look at the potential. As soon as you think and decide that you're going to take it off the honeycomb, it becomes that way. It's already liquid. Beis Hillel says, no, you have to wait till it actually happens. So we find that there are different disputes between Shammai and Beis Hillel, but you can explain it this way. Right. That's one way of explaining the dispute between Shammai and Beis Hillel. Let's have a look at the next one. Chal Omar, another one says no. Tamad of Beis Shammai, the reason of Beis Shammai, is keneged pari hachag. Very interesting reason. Beis Shammai says that the lights of Hanukkah have to correspond to the bulls of Sukkos. Now, what is that supposed to mean? So in the bulls of Sukkos, what's the bulls of Sukkos? So in the Musaf sacrifice on Sukkos, right, there were lots of bulls that were brought as a sacrifice, and the way it was done was as follows. The Musaf means an additional sacrifice for the Yontif. So Shabbos has a Musaf, Rosh Chodesh, Pesach, Shavuos, all that, right? In the Beis HaMikdash on Sukkos, there was a different Musaf brought each day, because throughout Sukkos, there was a total of 70 bulls that were offered up. But the way it was done is, it was in descending order. The first day of Sukkos, there were 13 bulls that were brought up as a Musaf sacrifice. The second day, there were 12. Third day, 11, and so on and so forth, until the last, I think, was 7. And the total of it is 70, and the 70 corresponds to the 70 nations. It's the whole thing. Okay? So it comes along Beis Shammai and says, well, the Hanukkah candle should resemble the bulls of Sukkos. And they were just like the bulls of Sukkos were in descending order. So too, the Hanukkah candle should be in descending order. Okay. So then what's Beis Hillel's claim? The Talmud of Beis Hillel, the reason of Beis Hillel says no. The Talmud of Beis Hillel, the Malin Bakolish Emirin. Because Beis Hillel says that no, there's a principle in Halacha that you always go up in all matters of holiness and you don't go down. Right? That's a general halachic rule. Unless, of course, the Torah mandates you should go down. But generally speaking, the law is that in all matters of Kedusha, you always go up. Right? Therefore, the Hanukkahs also have to go up. Right? What's this law? I'll give you an example. For example, I'll give you a simple, just one that comes to mind. In the laws of Tefillin, right? So the question is, let's say you have straps of, the head Tefillin and straps of the hand Tefillin, right? So can you change them? Like, let's say I've run out of straps or something. Can I take a straps from the hand tefillin and turn it into a head tefillin strap, or vice versa? So the halacha is, you can take hand tefillin and make it head tefillin, the strap and not the other way around. Not because it's physically up, actually. It's because the head tefillin is holier. For whatever reason, because it's four apartments rather than the hand tefillin. So the head tefillin has a greater kedusha than the hand tefillin, and therefore you can take handful and straps to make them headful and straps, but you can't do the other way around because we have Malin Bakoida, she always goes up in holiness and you don't go down. Okay. So before I go into these two particular reasons, I wanted to share with you an interesting thing, halachic thing, an interesting halachic analysis. It's a bit Talmudic today, Shir, I hope you don't mind. So it's interesting, let's just take Beis Hillel for example, right? Because we pass like Beis Hillel. So we have two reasons for Beis Hillel. I mean, we follow Beis Hillel's reasoning. We go from 1 to 8, and that's it, right? So we have two reasons. If someone would ask you, so why do you go from 1 to 8? So there's two reasons. One is that you go according to how many nights of Hanukkah you have. The other reason is because you go up in holiness, you don't go down, right? When the Gemara gives two reasons for halacha, one of the principles of learning Talmudic law is that it's not just academic. If there's two reasons for something, there must be a halachic difference between the two reasons. And even though in most cases there won't be any difference, because the bottom line is you start from one, you got eight. It's very simple. But there must be a case, this is the way we always learn Gemara, there must be a case where a situation arises and we need to know what to do, and it's going to depend on which reason we use. So let me give you two examples. And this is not, Baruch Hashem, it's not relevant nowadays, because nowadays, generally speaking, people have what they need, and people, especially enough candles around, enough oil, but there's a definite discussion in the Gemara where it's clear that there were times during Jewish history where getting candles, getting oil was a struggle. For example, there's another discussion in the same Gemara about Friday afternoon. Let's say someone only has enough oil for Shabbos candles or for Hanukkah candles, which one takes precedence? Right? Can you imagine that? A person only has a little bit of oil, doesn't have enough for either mitzvah, only has enough for either Shabbos candles or Hanukkah candles. The halacha is that Shabbos candles take precedence because of Shalom Bayis, because the purpose of Shabbos candles originally was to create light in the home. People shouldn't bump into each other, and there shouldn't be tension in the home, there should be peace in the home, and that takes precedence over the Hanukkah candles. Interesting point, interesting idea. But I'm just bringing that as an example where you see that there wasn't always the case where, you know, people had enough oil. Okay. So here's the scenario. A person has enough oil for the first night of Hanukkah, he lights one candle. Comes the second night of Hanukkah, he doesn't have enough oil for two candles, he only has one candle. Fine, not a problem. So he just won't do the Rolls Royce version. He won't do the Mahadrim and a Mahadrim. He can still fulfill the mitzvah of Hanukkah, because we know the mitzvah of Hanukkah is one candle, also does the trick. So he lights his one candle on the second night, and he still fulfills the mitzvah of Hanukkah, albeit not Mahadrim and a Mahadrim, but the minimum requirement. Fine. Comes the third night of Hanukkah, and now he's got two candles. He managed to scrounge around, and he's got two candles. Is there any point for him to light the two candles?
As opposed to three?
Just lighting. No, he doesn't have three.
No.
He doesn't have three. So he's only got a choice. He can just go back to the minimum requirement of doing one, but he has two, but it's the third night of Hanukkah. Should he light two?
I would say yes.
Why?
Light, and I think some part of the mitzvah better than...
No, but he's doing the one. Does two accomplish anything? You have to approach this halachically, like not just... No, because I say that important, because often people do that when you ask a question like in halacha, they say, oh, it feels right, you know, to do two. But we don't do halacha like that. You have to... Halacha is not an emotional thing. Halacha is a technical thing. Right? They might...
If one fulfills the mitzvah, then just like...
So here, it'll depend. No, but he'll have for next night. Let's say he's going to get for next night. We're not worried about the fourth night. Now we're in the third night. So it will depend on which reason we use. If the reason of Beis Hillel is that you go 1 to 8 because you always light corresponding to the number of nights of Hanukkah you already have, then there's absolutely no point to light two candles. It's not the second night of Hanukkah. It's the third night. Two candles on the third night of Hanukkah mean absolutely nothing. It's either one candle for the minimum mitzvah, or it's three candles corresponding to the third night of Hanukkah. Right? So then... don't worry about two candles, just like one candle. However, if you say the reason of Beis Hillel is because you always go up in matters of holiness and never go down, well, this guy should light two, because the second night of Hanukkah he only had one, so it wasn't his choice. He couldn't light two. But now he could light two, so he can go up. So go up in holiness. Light one extra. You look confused.
No, just that there are two maybe
different. So if he lights two, he'll be able to fulfill the second reason of going up in holiness. So you see, it's interesting. It's two reasons that the combination. I'll give you one more scenario because it's a bit more complicated, just to challenge you.
Yeah, because we did so well on
that. Okay, so guy has one candle the first night. He has one candle. He has two candles the second night. Okay. The third night, he only has two candles. Still, what should he do? Why? He can go up in holiness. It's only got
it's
two.
It's going to be the same.
It's going to be the same as yesterday. So, if we go according to the corresponding nights of Hanukkah, there's no point in doing two, because the third night of Hanukkah. But even according to the one of you got to go up, you can't go up.
Yep.
However, not so simple.
That's the bottom line.
No, because if you looked at the halachic phrase, there's two parts of the phrase. And you've got to be very, very careful. The phrase goes, Malim Bakodesh, you go up in holiness, the Ein Morin, and you don't go down in holiness. It's two separate parts of the phrase. So you're right, this fellow on the third night cannot fulfill the going up in holiness, but he could fulfill not going down in holiness. So there's still a point to light to. Because at least he won't be going up, but at least he won't be going down, it'll keep the same. So therefore, It would still make a difference. What reason? Okay.
Does one in their wisdom have to choose? Well, you can't chop and change and take somebody's.
No, no. So the truth is, we don't know which. No, no. So the truth is. Yeah, no, no. You would end up lying too. That's the. You're right. I mean, that's a good question. So what's the story? Because we don't know which reason we rule by.
But I mean, you would. Okay.
So we don't have a clear indication of which reason is actually the halacha. So therefore, you would incorporate both, and you would do whatever both reasons require. Okay. However, let's understand something very interesting here. According to the second reason, let's talk about the second reason now. Beis Shammai said you should go in descending order because it should be like the bulls of Sukkos. What on earth does the Hanukkah candles have to do with the bulls of Sukkos? I mean, what kind of reason that is that? Okay. Second of all, it's not only a question on Beis Shammai. It's even a question on Beis Hillel. If you look at Beis Hillel, he doesn't challenge. Beis Hillel argues with him, right? So we're giving the reasons. So it would be logical to say it like this. Beis Shammai says you go 8-1 because you'd be like the bulls of Sukkos, they go in descending order. And Beis Hillel says, what are you talking about? What's the connection between Sukkos and Hanukkah? Right? That could have been a good argument. He doesn't say that. So the Mefarshim explained that Beis Hillel actually does not dispute the connection to Sukkos. He just says we have an overriding principle. Beis Hillel is not intrinsically arguing with the connection between Sukkos and Hanukkah, or between the Hanukkah candles and the cows of Sukkah, or the bulls of Sukkos. He's just saying, you can't do that because we have an overriding principle. There's a principle in Halacha that you have to go up in holiness and not go down, unless the Torah specifically tells you you have to go down, like in the case of the bulls of Sukkos. So I agree with you, there's a connection, but we have to go up because it's an overriding principle. So, both according to Beis Shammai and according to Beis Hillel, we have to actually understand what is the intrinsic connection between between Hanukkah and Sukkos, or between the bulls of Sukkos. So I'm going to share with you an interesting concept. We actually see that there's quite a lot of connection between Hanukkah and Sukkos. We need to understand what that is and where it comes from. Go back to the very... No, sorry, I didn't copy that part. Oh, I should have. Doesn't matter. When the Gemara talks about lighting the Hanukkah candles, it says, and this is an interesting halachic, it's a clear halachic thing, which actually is problematic in the southern hemisphere, sometimes. It says the Hanukkah candles have to be Mishatishka Hachamo, when the sun goes down. Right? Even though in public places and on Erev Shabbos, we can light the Hanukkah candles from a time called Plaga Mincha, which right now is around 6:30. But in your own private home, one actually should not light the Hanukkah candles that early, clearly. It's very, very clear in Halacha. One should light them after the sun has gone down. Yeah?
When is that?
You can light up to 9 o'clock, or if people are awake, you can light even later. But should be from, that's I think that's about 5 to 8 or something like that, right? That would be the minimum time. But they need to burn till a half an hour after nightfall, which is about 9 o'clock. So if you light at 5 to 8, make sure the candles are long enough to burn till 9.
Do it up until midnight?
Yeah, you can. As long as people are up in the house, that's long as it. Yeah. That's the halacha. Nowadays, it used to be a bit more strict, but nowadays, because we light inside, so that's more for the people and the family, so that's why we can light up to then. But it should be from Mishtish, with an emphasis, which is very interesting, because the menorah that we light on Hanukkah actually comes to remember a miracle that took place with the menorah in the temple in the Beis HaMikdash. And in the Beis HaMikdash, the menorah was not kindled at night. It burned throughout the night, but it was not kindled at night. It was kindled by daytime, in the afternoon. Okay. So we have this concept of Mishatishka HaChamo, when the Chamo goes down. Now what's very fascinating is that we use the word Chamo for sun, right? The sun has two words, Shemesh and Chamo. And here we say, we don't say Mishtishka HaShemesh when the Shemesh goes down, but we talk about Mishtishka HaChamo when the Chamo goes down. Okay. It means warmth, yeah, it means warmth, but it's reference to the sun, right? Sun is called Chamo. Tishka HaChamo when the sun goes down, so that we're overpowering the sun. The sun, the Chamo, is disappearing. Get that? We have a similar concept by sukkahs. A kosher sukkah, what determines how kosher a sukkah is? So there's a thing, tsilosa meruba mechamosa, that the shade has to be more than the sun. And the same term for sun is used. Tsilosa meruba mechamosa, that the shade is more than the chamo, than the sun. Right? What's the concept? We also find another connection between Sukkot and Chanukah, of course, is that they're both 8 days. Right? Sukkot is 7 days, but it's got Shmini Atzeres, which is different in some aspects, but in some aspects it's called Shmini Atzeres. It's an 8 days, so therefore it's part of Sukkot. And Chanukah, we also have the concept of 8 days. Right? How does this all fit into Chanukah? What's the idea? The idea is as follows. Let's just talk about this concept of the Chama, the sun. So it says in Kabbalistic works that the concept of Chama comes from the word warmth. But it's a negative warmth. It's a passion, an enthusiasm in materialism. That's what it refers to. Right? Which fits into another concept. We need to understand that concept, however. It fits into a concept where we find that we pride ourselves that our calendar says Yisrael Moinin Lalavona. The calendar counts the calendar according to the moon. Right? That's how the Jewish people do it. And the phrase continues that the Umos Ha'olam, nations of the world, the idolaters, in other words, we are taught, follow their calendar according to the sun. And they're the same terms used, the chama, the sun, right? And we always, so the context of that discussion always is that calendar is more holy. The calendar we have is a holier calendar, so to speak. And we need to understand that because sometimes we talk about the sun being a good thing, right? We need to understand that the symbolism of the sun. What do I mean? There's a very famous pasuk, there's a very famous verse in Tilim, I think it is. It says, Kishemesh Umogain Hashem Elokim. And there are two names for Hashem in the Torah. Hashem, Yudke Vavke, and Elokim. As we spoke about many times, Yudke Vavke is the name of God that represents how God is expressed infinitely, His infinite presence. And Elokim is how God manifests Himself in a more limited way, in a concealed way. Right? And says the Tilim, it says the Pasuk, that an analogy for that is Shemesh Umogen, the sun and the shield around the sun. Which I learned recently, actually that's a physical thing. You know, there's different layers of the sun. The sun in its purity would be impossible to absorb in this earth. It would burn up. But the sun has like a shield around, like an outer layer of the sun, through which the rays of the sun shine to us, and that makes it possible to actually get the sun. So there's this concept of the sun and the shield around the sun, the layer around the sun that protects the intensity of the sun, that it shouldn't be fully revealed, that it waters down and dilutes the intensity of the sun. Says the Pasuk, that those two parts of the sun is an analogy for Shemesh Umogen. The Shemesh, the sun, and the shield of the sun is like Yud Kei Vav Kei and Elohim. That Yud Kei Vav Kei is Hashem's infinite presence, that's the Shemesh itself, whereas the shield around the sun, that's the concept of Elohim. So there, in that context, the sun is represented the essence of God. Right? It's the infinity of Hashem. So what's the concept of Chama? We talk about Chama, the sun, and diluting the sun and making sure it disappears, and so on and so forth. What's the concept of being a negative thing? So the way it works is like this. Then when we talk about the non-Jewish or the idolatrous calendar originating around the sun, or we talk about the sun being this idea of negative passion, or the way it's hinted in a pasuk in Parshas Noach, where it's brought down and it says, One of the sons of Noach was Cham, right? Same word. Shem, Cham, and Yafes. And Cham is always a negative one. He was the one who made all the trouble. And it says in the Pasuk, the Cham hu avi Canaan. Cham is the father of Canaan. Now Canaan in the Torah is not a symbolism of a good thing. Canaan is a symbolism of the seven nations which occupied Eretz Yisrael, and they were the negative, which represent the seven bad emotions and idolatrous emotions and negative personalities and so on and so forth. So what does the Pasuk say? It says, V'cham, the Cham was the father of Canaan, which the mystics explain to mean that Cham, passion, Chamimus, warmth, excitement, in materialism and in negative things, breeds all the negative personality traits. So Cham becomes the father of Canaan. What does that mean? So we say like this, let's explain the following. That when we say that Chamo, we talk about Chamo being a negative thing, or Cham, or whatever the case is, we're not talking about the sun in its purity. The sun in its purity is called Shemesh. The sun and the purity is Hashem's infinity. When we talk about Chama, we talk about something they refer to as Galgal Chama, which is the orbit of the sun, which means how the sun relates to us, which is how the sun has been diluted through its shield and how it's shining in a way where it's not the same intensity as the sun itself. Now, That concept that Hashem created this concealment, that Hashem concealed Himself, the Elohim, when He created the world through the name of Elohim, as we've spoken about many times, in the 6 days of creation, you only see the name of Elohim. So that's a concept where Hashem knew that if he reveals His complete intensity, His infinite intensity, the world cannot exist the way it exists today, right? So in order to create a finite world, He needed to conceal Himself. So the concealment, in essence, is not a bad thing. However, because it's really to give us a glimpse of Hashem and to tolerate the sun in its analogy and so on and so forth. However, once you have the concept of concealment, that's where it becomes dangerous. In other words, concealment could be taken in the wrong way. So Hashem creates a world which really conceals God's presence, conceals God's infinity, which really needs to be understood and taken as just that. It needs to be taken as a structure that Hashem created so we should be able to exist, but really we need to be able to look beneath the concealment and discover the true essence of Hashem in this world. It's just a mechanism for us. But because there's a curtain there, because there's a darkness there, it's very easy to get caught up in the darkness rather than the little ray of light which is supposed to shine through the darkness. And that's why that concealment becomes the source of a negative sun, a negative chamimus, and becomes the source of this concept of cham being a negative thing, which is the chamimus, the passion, the excitement, and the attraction towards darkness, physicality, idol worship, materialism, and so on and so forth. Which is the story of Hanukkah. That's exactly what the story of Hanukkah is. What was the story of Hanukkah all about? About the Yevonim, about the Greeks, who wanted to introduce the Greek culture. What was the Greek culture? The Greek culture was exactly that. The Greek culture was to ignore the rays of light behind the superficial layer of shield around the protection. In other words, it was to focus on the curtain rather than the rays of the sun shining through the curtain. The whole essence of Greek culture was to take God out of the equation and to focus on the sports stadiums and the physical body. It was all about serving the body. That was the whole concept of Hanukkah. Therefore, Hanukkah, really the war that is represented by the Yontif of Hanukkah, is exactly that war. It's the war about getting distracted and getting drawn towards complete superficiality and materialism and hedonism and all those things that allow you to be taken away from discovering the light behind the curtain and focusing only on the superficial curtain, which in translated means to be completely immersed in the material world, in the physical world, in the superficial outer layer, rather than discovering God behind the outer layer. That's the concept of Hanukkah. How do you fight that? So therefore the Gemara says, how do you fight that? You have to light the Hanukkah candles. And the purpose of Hanukkah candles is Mishatishka Hachama. That's why you light it after the Shkia, after the sun goes down. Because the idea of Hanukkah candles is to weaken the Chama, to let it go down, to make it disappear. Right? To weaken the Chama. How do you do that? Through the Hanukkah candles. What do the Hanukkah candles represent? The Hanukkah candles represent Emunah. What was the Hanukkah candles? What was the miracle of Hanukkah candles? The miracle of the Hanukkah candles was all about that one jug of oil that they had found with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. So we mentioned this before, but the whole concept of the seal, the jug with the seal of the Kohen Gadol was a symbol of what's at the deepest point of a Jew. That in order, because the Jews had been, it wasn't just a war, but that it was a successful war, because they had been so spiritually damaged, the only way to counter that was to bring out the jug of oil that we all have at the very, very essence, which is protected by the seal of the Kohen Gadol, which means that at the core essence of every year, there's the emunah, the faith, which cannot be corrupted. In other words, it cannot be destroyed. It's always intact with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. It's a small jug of oil. It's very hidden. It needs to be discovered. It needs to be looked at. It needs to be found, but it's there. And that's Hanukkah. Hanukkah is about bringing out that small jug of oil so that we can reveal our emunah. Once we reveal our true emunah, we can start focusing on God again and shift away from the focus of chama, of the enthusiasm and the passion and the materialism, and bring it back to the focus of God. Right? That's the pshat. That's why you light Hanukkah candles. Mishat tishka hachama. And the truth is that the same thing is with Sukkos. The reason that the bullocks of Sukkos go down in order, wherever normally things of kedusha go up in order, is because that's exactly what happens on Sukkos. Sukkos is also, what is the schach of Sukkos? Why do we say that the schach of Sukkos, the shade, must be more than the chama? What is that shade of Sukkos? What is it? So in our Pikabola, the shade of Sukkos, we've talked about this before, it's a manifestation of the cloud that the Kohen Gadol saw in the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. Right? That's why the schach is considered so holy. When we sit under the schach on Sukkos, the reason the schach is so holy is because when the Kohen Gadol used to go into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, and he would experience the cloud of glory in that Holy of Holies made through the incense, right? Which is all about the pintali. It's all about the emunah. We've spoken about this before. The smell, idea of smell, is that part of the neshama that cannot be contaminated. So that's what the Kohen Gadol would see. That kedusha, that holiness, that emunah comes out afterwards in the shade of the sukkah, also like a cloud. And that gives the ability then, when you reveal the emunah, the revealed attachment that you really have to Hashem, you just have to reveal it, that weakens the chama, that weakens the shade. Therefore, kosher sukkah is where tzilosa, where the shade overpowers the sun, but chama overpowers the negative aspect of the sun, which is the chamimus, the warmth, the excitement in an olam hazeh. The problem is that in sukkahs, it's still in the context of a yontif, it's context of in the spiritual context, where it really comes out and is really properly revealed that we can implement it on a daily basis is through the yontif of Chanukah, because that's how the year works generally. That what happens on Tishrei is more sort of spiritual. Sukkah is a bit more physical than Yom Kippur, but then if it comes out properly and is revealed in a much greater way during the Yom Tov of Sukkah, during Yom Tov of Chanukah. So both Yom Tov is about revealing the emunah of the Jew and giving the Jew the ability to fight the chama. That's why the bullocks of Sukkah are in descending order, because descending order means what do the bullocks represent? It's the bull represents always the strength of physicality. Right, it's the animalistic part of creation, and although the animalistic part of creation has to be used and has to be channeled, but its strength has to be weakened, and that's represented by the sukkahs korbanis, starting with 13, but going down, because that's the power of sukkahs. That strength of the animal becomes weakened and weakened through the power of sukkahs. Says Beis Shammai, therefore, the same thing has to happen with sukkah with Chanukah, because since Chanukah is exactly the same thing as sukkahs, where we take the chama, we should tishka hachama, we're letting the chama sink, we're letting the chama disappear. We're trying to weaken the focus on the material and the physical. Therefore, it needs to be reflected on the Chanukah candles to go down in descending order to represent the same idea of weakening the powers and the forces of the material and the physical. Comes along Beis Hillel and says, you're right, but no. Why? It is true that was Chanukah is. That's why you light them after the Shkia. That's why you light them when the chama goes down. But Chanukah candles have to go up, because Chanukah candles don't represent that which needs to be minimized. Chanukah candles is the tool which you use to minimize it. And because Chanukah candles is the tool, it's the light, it's the emunah which you use, that has to get stronger. Ma'alin b'kodesh has to go up in holiness. So they're really talking about the same thing. They're talking about two aspects of the Chanukah candles. Beis Shammai is focusing on the outcome. Beis Hillel is focusing on the strategy. They agree really on the essence of Chanukah, but because according to Beis Hillel, the focus of Chanukah candles is more about the strategy, the tool, rather than the outcome. He says the outcome is the minimization of the chama, but the tool is the increasing of strength of the emunah through the Chanukah candles, and that's why it has to go in ascending order. That's the connection to sukkahs, and that explains what the connection to sukkahs is, and that explains the machlokes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel on a spiritual level.